Just going to get things set up here for a minute. All right, my name is Brooke Sherman. I'm a grateful member of the Family Groups of Al-Anon. And I'd like to thank Tim for inviting me and picking me up at the airport and bringing me here, and Bruce for introducing me and taking me to lunch. And I want to thank all of you members who were so gracious when I came here to inform me that, not to worry, but the Friday night speaker was only the most important speaker who set the tone for the weekend, and not to worry about it. So thanks, guys. But one of the things I'm going to assure you is that this is going to be a great talk. And the reason why is because I talked to Greg Newman, the taper, before I started, and he informed me that the difference between a good talk and a great talk is that if the taper was mentioned. So we've taken care of that, and it is going to be a good meeting. But just to give you some of the my vital statistics, the second time I came to Al-Anon and stayed was June 1st, 1999. I do have a sponsor, and I do sponsor other men. I have a home group, which is the Tuesday night adult children meeting in Richmond, Virginia. If you ever find yourself on a Tuesday night in Richmond, Virginia, come by and see us. The meeting starts at 7:30, but be prepared to stay for 90 minutes because it's an hour and a half. We have a speaker, and then we have a discussion. So it's a great format, good meeting. And if I make any disparaging comments about the meeting of what it was like when I was new, the meeting has changed and is much healthier now. So it's a great meeting. And I also like to thank AA. It's easy here because this is there are a lot of you here, but because AA has been very kind to Al-Anon. Not only did you, graciously give us your steps and traditions and tell us to take them and, modify them as we need them so we could get better, but you've invited us in to your open meetings so we could hear your message of recovery and understand the disease of alcoholism. And on a personal note, I would like to thank AA because my last three sponsors have been members of AA. Those of you who are familiar with Al-Anon, you know we're a little woman heavy, and so it's kind of hard to find a man sometimes. So I was very, very excited to see all the guys from Al-Anon who stood up. That was great. One of the things that I like to remind myself when we speak is that we're a crowd that shares a lot, and I just want to try to remember to share our recovery, not just our sickness. And in keeping with that idea, I'm going to start kind of into my story a little bit. Towards the end of my third year when that spiritual, I've already worked the steps, and recovery has already happened. That spiritual awakening has already happened. Partially because this is about recovery. And on the less healthy side, I want you to think well of me, so I want to tell some of the good stuff first before you hear where I came from. But anyway, it was about towards the end of my third year in Al-Anon, and I had finally worked the steps the way my sponsor had suggested. It only took about three times, and something strange happened. I had that spiritual awakening, and things got a lot better. And suddenly, and I was a little hesitant when I came in to do that because, as I said, this is not my first time in Al-Anon, and I had worked the steps 10 years before I came in, as you'll hear later on. And so when I worked the steps the second time with my sponsor, I thought I was doing him a favor because, obviously I was already a pillar of sanity. And, I figured sponsors got credit for that. So I was quite offended when he suggested that I work them again. But that time I did take some direction, and the miracle happened for me. And part of that was part of the reason I was so resistant is because when I came in, as I mentioned, my home group was not as healthy as it is now. And I saw a lot of guys with, between 15 and 20 years who were completely miserable. And I did not want to hang around this group as long as they did to be that miserable. I wanted to get better. And I was assured that there were people around who had that recovery, and I just need to go look for it because I was doing maybe one meeting a week for the first little while I was in. And so shortly after that, I heard that there was a speaker coming to town because I was very interested in the idea of what long-term recovery looked like. And there was this guy coming to town. He was coming to help out at the prisons because a group of AAs had started taking these meetings to the jails, and it was kind of based on the way they felt AA had started with, and they felt they needed to reach out and stuff. And so this guy wanted to support that because he'd been around when they started, because he had actually gotten sober the week before Bill W. had. So I figured I wasn't going to see too much more long-term sobriety than that. He had 68 years back then. He was 93 years old, still spry and moving around. And the kind of the hook for that meeting was, that they were inviting people to come to the jails with them. Now, one of the things, when I had that spiritual awakening, I made a, doing my 11 step one day, I made a deal with my higher power because I'd been resistant, as I mentioned, and that if I was ever asked to do something in service, not only would I say yes, but I would say yes right away, and I would say yes without a resentment, because those three things had never gone together before. And so right after I had that prayer, if you do decide to pray that, good for you. I just want to caution you that your life might get very interesting, because what happened when I did that was I went to that meeting, and the pitch was, come to the jail with us and bring recovery. And I went, isn't this great? There were about 300 people there, just like there are here. And I said, I get to go up after the meeting and say, I want to volunteer and not have to do it, because I'm an Al-Anon. So I get to look good, which is important, and not have to do anything. Yeah, it's tailor-made for me. So after the meeting, I went up. The gentleman I'm about to mention has passed away, so I'm not breaking his anonymity, but John Mayo was the gentleman who was bringing AA into the jails there. And went up to John. I think I was it for the people who came up. There wasn't a line. And I went to John and said, John, I would like to go to the jails with you. He said, great, come to my house, we'll do all the paperwork and all that kind of stuff. I went, but John, I can't do it. He said, why not? He goes, I'm an Al-Anon. And he went, He goes, well, it's the same disease, it's the same solution, just come and share your experience, strength, and hope. And that deal I'd made with God about doing things without a resentment went right out the window. And I'm sitting there going now I got to go to the jail with all the drunks and the addicts who did this to me? So I prayed about it, and the message I got back from God was to go four times. And I was puzzled by this, because what was I going to do? I mean, I go to meetings so that I don't help alcoholics. So what could I possibly bring to the prison situation? I figured it was going to be something with just getting to know the guys who went and did that, and it would improve my recovery, and I'd get something out of it, because obviously the most important part of this exercise is me getting something out of it. And so I went, and the first time I went, I was shocked. It was a wing, they call them pods. There was this pod of 80 guys, and these guys were hardcore. All they did was work the steps. So in other words, if they weren't eating three times a day, that's 3 hours, exercising 1 hour a day, or sleeping, that's 8 hours a day, they were working the steps. And what they would do is they would go through the 12 steps with the sponsor. That would take them 2.5 days, switch sponsors, and do it again. And that's what they did, 7 days a week. And I was shocked when I got there, because it's the first time I was in an AA meeting where I was actually comparing myself in instead of comparing myself out. They're fun guys there, run meth labs, had killed people in DUIs and stuff, because you had to be locked up for 2 years before you got into this jail. So anyway, went there, came back, and figured that was it. Came back the second time. And I gather at that group, if they're going through doing four steps with everybody else there, they all knew each other's stories. So I guess if you come back to the jail again, that qualifies you to be a speaker, because they said, let the new guy talk. And so I got up there, and I'd learned in Richmond that when I would go to an open AA meeting and be asked to identify myself, because a lot of the meetings would say, is anybody here at this meeting for their first time or the first AA meeting ever, introduce yourselves. I learned to say, hi, my name is Brooke, I'm an Al-Anon, rather than just saying, hi, my name is Brooke, because if I just said, hi, my name is Brooke, I would find several gentlemen after the meeting who informed me they were my new best friend and they were my sponsor. And I found at that point, it's not a good time to say I don't have a drinking problem. So I said, you know, I said, hi, I'm Brooke, I'm in Al-Anon, and started on. And, you know, like I said, these guys are really hardcore AA, so I was really shocked when a guy in the third row about right where you're sitting spoke up and interrupted me, because that just didn't happen in the meetings I'd seen. And now this guy was backwoods country. And he said, excuse me, what's that? Who? And I'm looking out going like, is this a prison joke? And I'm sorry, sir, I can't understand you. And he goes, what's an ahu? Look, I know what ack is. I know what an alcoholic is. You said you're an ahu. And I went, Al-Anon? He goes, yeah, what's that? And I didn't know what to say. I'd never asked that question before. Fortunately, I had my daily reader. And so I opened it up and read the preamble of Al-Anon, which kind of explains what it is. And I don't know if you've ever been in a crowded room and said something, and the room gets really quiet, and not in the good way, really quiet, but in the bad way. And I was looking down as I finished reading it, and the room got that quiet, and I just went, my recovery went out the window at this point, and I went, oh crap, I've just told the enemy that I'm on the other side. And I went, and the other thought that flew through my mind is, this is when you go to the jails in Richmond, one of the things you have to do is sign a waiver every time you come in, which I'll summarize it for you. If something happens, we're not coming to get you. You know? So that thought goes through my mind, and I go, like, no problem. There's always a guard. You know, look around. The guards aren't in the pod. There's never a cop when you need one, is there? I looked for John. He was off in a separate room, counseling somebody. And I said, no problem. I was in the Marine Corps. I can handle 80 convicts. I am really getting ready to flip out at this point. When that gentleman says, this must have happened in a fleeting second in my mind, says, you mean there's something out there for our wives and kids? And I was able to say yes. And I realized that I did have something to bring those men. And, you know, the problem I think I had at that time was that I had been affected by the disease of alcoholism growing up. And one of the things that went awry was my definitions. And I've since learned, one of my sponsors taught me, that what I needed to do is look up definitions of words, and especially look past the first definition down into them, because what I thought, I didn't think I was willing. Because of what I thought the definition of willingness was, prompt to act or respond, accepted by choice, or without reluctance. I have never done anything in this program by that definition. However, one of the other definitions of willingness is inclined or favorably disposed in mind to. And I can do that. And you guys taught me that difference. And if I'm just willing to bring a little willingness to the table, God can do amazing things. And so, you know, I always thought that being a speaker would be kind of fun and interesting, because I went to a lot of AA speaker meetings and Al-Anon speaker meetings because I wanted to find out, you know, really what was going on. And I heard people get up there and talk about how they were going to tell about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I thought that would be really cool. Because if I talked about what it's like, I got to talk about you guys and what you had done to me and all that kind of stuff. And I got to be a perfect victim, which is probably why no one ever asked me to speak. But, you know, some of my friends in AA informed me when I was mentioning this, that is not what it says. It says what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now, which translates to me as what I'm like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Because if I had to admit to you guys what I was like, I would have to say I was self-centered, cruel, sarcastic, consumed with fear and rage, but I would have tried to convince you I was a nice guy, because appearances are important, because that's how I was raised. And growing up, four things really impacted my life. you know, obviously, I was raised in a family that had been affected by the disease of alcoholism. I had a really severe learning disability, which kind of even overshadowed that. Fortunately, I had a great relationship with God. You know, God was doing for me what I can do for myself long before I knew that was a possibility. And the last thing was I had a plan. Now, this room seems to be a good bit more than 50% AA, and I suspect you guys have run into people like me, unrecovered Al-Anons with a plan. And I suspect they're not fun. But anyway, my plan was to, let me first kind of describe to you what that combination did to me and what it looked like, because for me it was normal. It was just every day, and I'm sure a lot of you in the room can relate to that. But, you know, there's one story I remembered after getting recovery, because it was a very unique day. I've met a couple guys in here who, spent some time in Washington, D.C., lived there or something like that. But I grew up in outside Washington, D.C., and I walked to school. And D.C. has a lot of circles, and the circle that I lived on was called Chevy Chase Circle. And I was walking around it the way I went to school every day. And that's when my left foot hit the ground, I'd say I'm stupid. And my right foot hit the ground, I say I'm dumb. And that's the way I used to walk to school every day. And that's the way I used to walk home every day. Because I did not like school. But it was better than home. And, you know, as I was doing that, when I was on the northwest corner of Chevy Chase Circle, you know, I thought I was saying it to myself, but I must have been saying it out loud, because all of a sudden I heard this loud voice behind me say, "No!" And I spun around, and there was nothing there. But it's another one of those examples of, but the thing was, after that, I walked the rest of the way to school not saying I'm dumb, I'm stupid, but thinking about, what was that voice? And today, I believe that was my higher power, once again, doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because that's what alcoholism does to people. And so what happened? Well, anyway, I implemented my plan, which was to grow up, go into the military when I was 18, so I could be fully self-supporting and never have anything to do with my family again as long as I lived. And unfortunately, I did not understand that wherever I went, there I was. And that's where the problem was. What happened? Well, I did grow up. I did go to the military. But it didn't get better. You know, I thought, you know, if only I can get into the Naval Academy, life will be good. And I got in there, and it wasn't. Well, only if I get a certain grades, life will be good. And it didn't work. If only I can get a certain rank, it will be. Didn't happen. Well, maybe when I get into the Marines. And on and on and on, and life just sucked. It was just one damn thing after another, and I didn't know what was wrong or how to change it. What happened? Well, I found out about the 12 steps in kind of an indirect way. It was, I believe, in 1988. It was the Martin Luther King holiday weekend, and it was between Sunday night and Monday morning, and my phone rang. And I was a captain in the Marine Corps by this time. And one of the things I had learned was, with your phone rings at that time of night, you do not pick it up. You let it go to voicemail so you can find out what they did and what happened before you have to call back and be coherent about what we're going to do about it. But this was strange, because it rang about 20 to 30 times, and there was no message until that last time, and there was a message from the friend of a woman I had broken up with, telling me she was in jail for drugs and alcohol, and I needed to go bail her out. And, you know, the strange thing about this relationship is not that she was a former girlfriend, because that happened a lot, but that I was the one who'd done the breaking up, because I was one of those people who hang in there to the last minute, you know, please don't leave. You know, I was, you know, I had a very good posture about that, and, you know, just, anyway, but, you know, I'm going, like, my first thought was, you know, I do not go and bail people out of jail. I put them in jail when they do drugs and alcohol. I don't get them out. And I said that as I got up, and I got dressed, and I said it again as I was thinking about how to get the money together, and how to get a bail bondsman, and where the jail was, you know. We tend not to think about that, but most people don't have any reason to know where jail is unless they've been there before. So I did all that, and by that time it was about 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I started driving down. This is in Southern California, so I'm driving down I-5 to go to the jail in San Diego. And I'm just thinking, I don't have to do this, but I couldn't stop. And just to shut the craziness that was going on in my head, I turned on talk radio. And you can imagine the types of talk radio programs there are in Southern California on a holiday weekend night at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was this woman talking about a book she'd just written about codependency. And I was kind of intrigued because it sounded like a lot of what I was going through. And, the good thing was she talked about how there was a solution. And I was relieved. And so what I did is I came up with a new plan. What I was going to do then was I was going to drive down, bail her out, tell her never to talk to me again, drive her home, and then go home. It never once entered my mind that if I turned around on I-5 and gone home, I would have gained a couple hours sleep, been $500 richer, and gotten the same message across to her. But we learn what we can. So the next day I bought that book, read it. The 12 Steps of AA was in the back, and that's when I started working the steps. Now, I don't remember reading anything about meetings or anything like that, so I just, fortunately, I did have a spiritual mentor at that time. He, to the best of his ability, took me through the steps. Unfortunately, it seems like we have a lot of people, or a number of people here who were in recovery back in the 80s. Do you guys remember a term called family of origin work? Yeah. The book mentioned that, and what that was is before you could solve your problems, you needed to delve into the history of your family to find out where they came from before you could solve the problem. So I started this. I started calling my family and asking them questions and things like that, and this did not go over very well. And suddenly it was announced that we were going to have a family reunion, which we hadn't had in 10 years. I'm the youngest, and everybody else was, all over the country. So we're all going to get together in Newport Beach, which is just outside of L.A. I didn't find out till later that the purpose of this reunion was me. And I like to call what happened over that next week the reverse intervention. I'm sure some of you have been involved in interventions before, and this was kind of the opposite of that, to talk me out of this nonsense. And although they all agreed I had problems, they wanted to let me know that I did not get them in our family. And I got that message loud and clear. I realized, I couldn't have put it into words, but what I realized is they would rather have me die than talk about this disease or talk about our family secrets. And, for a lot of years, I had a resentment to my family about that. I didn't even realize it. Because, I didn't realize what alcoholism does. And the best way I can describe it is I'm from Maryland. I grew up in Maryland. And we go crabbing in Maryland. Anybody here ever been crabbing? Okay, good. Well, for those of you who haven't, I'll explain it to you. What you do is you get like a turkey neck or chicken neck, take a string, and you go to a pier down by the seashore or on the inland where there are crabs. But one of the most vital pieces of equipment is a 12-quart granite stock pot. There's a big thing like that with a lid. You have to have the lid. Because what you do is you throw that turkey neck in the water, and as soon as a crab grabs onto it, you haul them up, you throw them in the pot, and you put the lid on real quick. And then you go do it again, because if you leave the lid off, they'll crawl out. They can get out, and they'll just go back in. Well, you got to make sure you put the lid on until you get about 2 or 3 of them in there. And once you do that, you don't have to put the lid on again, because as one of them tries to crawl out, the others reach up and pull them back in. And you see, that's what alcoholism does to families. Because alcoholism, in my experience, does not come for the alcoholic. It comes for the entire family. And that's one of the reasons I'm a big advocate of the Al-Anon and the family disease, and the model of the family disease, because we all need to get better from this. Even then, with all that angst going on, my higher power was working for me. because what my job and my family became for the next two and a half years was to find out how this had happened to me other than alcoholism in our family. And that search led me to find a doctor who was able to deal with my learning disability. And a wonderful man worked with me for about 9 months, and then I did not have the problems anymore. The challenge is that had been kind of a shield for me of keeping, we joke about detaching in Al-Anon, but that was automatically a buffer for me. I couldn't engage people that closely because I just would get overwhelmed with being too close to people, so I was having to keep people at distance, which I think helped me greatly. But once that was gone, all the filters were off, and what I had done for almost 30 years crashed in on me all at once. And I didn't have a solution. Again, I still had a kind of a spiritual mentor or a spiritual director. You know, he referred me to a therapist. I went in to speak to him. I think we were about seven minutes into the session when he said, "You ever heard of Al-Anon?" And I was going like, "Al-who?" Yeah. And the reason why that is, the only reason why that's strange is because in the military, we get training in how to intervene on alcoholics. That is really good. I mean, if the person is willing to come forward and turn themselves in, they'll go to treatment. If they ever relapse, we throw them out. If they're not willing, we throw them out. Because left to my own devices, I would have people living with me. You try to fix them rather than let them have consequences. But fortunately, there was that structure the military put in place. So, you know, but even with all the work I did with a spiritual mentor and a therapist, there wasn't a spiritual solution. I mean, my spiritual mentor had it, but I didn't know how to get there. There wasn't any guidance on how to do it. I just tried to do my best, and it wasn't good enough. And the therapist uncovered a lot of stuff, but again, there wasn't an answer. And this is my experience. I know lots of people who've done very well in therapy. But what it did do is uncovered what I was doing. And I found I was doing to other people that I loved what my family had done to me, and I swore I would die before I let that happen. And so I came up with another plan of how to kill myself. There was one problem with that. The faith tradition I grew up in doesn't allow you to commit suicide unless you're crazy. So, how do you know you're crazy? How do you go far enough into the craziness so you get to, pass go and go to the good place and not pass go and go to, not whatever. You understand what I'm saying. I was sharing this with a sponsee one day. I was driving, he was in the passenger seat, and I looked over and there was this horrified look looking at me when I shared this story with him, and he just went, "Dude, you so belong in the program." And I'm glad I had some reinforcement to that, but what I figured was if I held out long enough before I blew my brains out, I would cross that line, I'd be able to go to the good place and not the bad place. And thus began one of the most horrific years in my life. And what happened was there's a time frame in my religion's religious calendar every year. It's kind of just before spring, where for about 6 weeks, everybody worldwide gets together and tries to do something to improve their relationship with God. And so I still had a relationship. I still talk to God, and I still feel God talk to me. So I asked God. I'm getting ready to blow my brains out, and I say, "God, what should I do to improve my relationship with you?" Right? So anyway, the response I got came back, "Get a dog." Now, I have always wanted a dog, but, like so many other things in families that are kind of dealing with the disease of alcohol, there's not a lot of room for a lot of things, and there definitely wasn't room for a dog in our family. And so I started arguing. I didn't have the time, I didn't have the money. Anyway, all those were not true, and I realized that very quickly. So finally I came up with the capital one. I just said, "God, I have abandonment issues." Now, how I knew I had abandonment issues, I have no idea. I don't know where that thought came from, but I knew I had abandonment issues. and I'm going to get this dog, blow my brains out, and I'm going to abandon it. And that would be cruel. You must be a cruel God making me do this. And fortunately, my higher power knows how to detach. Because the response I got back was, then don't. You asked me what to do, I told you. And that sucks, because now it's all on me again. So I went, oh, fine, I'll get a dog, I'll show you. You know? So by the end of that 40-day period, I had gotten a dog. I went to pick up a dog, and I had decided to get an older dog, so one that was 2 years old. The breeder had said that I could have her personal pet because she was trying to cut down her stock. And she thought that would be a good match, and so I went to pick her up. And unfortunately, that morning was Easter Sunday, which those of you who are Christians realize that's a significant day. And I wondered if this was any message from God that the pickup had been arranged for that day. And like I got up there, the woman also raised horses, and she had a full die on her, giving, you know, die on birth. So she was an emotional wreck. And so I said, fine, let me just take the dog, and I'll go home. And so we tried to get the dog into my car when it dawned on us that we were taking a two-year dog from its owner and kidnapping it and forcing it into my car. So we finally, and she started breaking down crying when this happened because it had been an emotional day for her. So we finally wrestled this 60-pound German Shepherd into my car, shut the door. The dog is, you know, glued to the window next to it, just shaken because I'm kidnapping her from her owner. I'm driving back to Richmond, and I'm thinking, God, this is a wonderful plan. And I get home, and this dog goes to the farthest away part in the house from me that she can. As I move, she moves. And she's staying away from me. Won't take food, anything. And so I finally went to bed, and you know, I had a little rancher with wooden floors and tile in the kitchen and the laundry room, and she was in the laundry room. And I went to bed, and I had that thought, going like, God, great plan going on here. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, I heard this horrendous crash from the laundry room. It sounded like all the cabinets had fallen down. And I heard the dog come walking down the road. We had a little paws on when they got their long toenails. And anyway, she comes in, looked up at me, laid down, went to sleep, and never left my side for the rest of her night, for the rest of her life. And, you know, the next day I went up, and one of my reasons for thinking I couldn't get a dog is because I didn't want to abandon a dog at all. So I wanted a place I could work where I could take a dog to work, and I checked with my boss, and he said, sure. So I took her to work with me. And, you know, something was wrong. Something was very wrong. I couldn't identify it, but just things were wrong. I thought it was something to do with the dog and work and stuff. So anyway, went home. That happened again on Tuesday. It happened again on Wednesday. And it wasn't until Wednesday evening when I came home that I was able to identify what that thing that was wrong was. I hadn't had a suicidal thought in 3 days. I hadn't gone 5 minutes during any day without thinking, can I do it now? For the previous year. Now I ask you, what does a German Shepherd have to do with curing a suicidal depression? None of the professionals I went to and paid money to came up with that solution. None of the spiritual guys I went to came up with that solution. But my higher power was once again doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And so what happened after that? Well, you know, if you're planning on killing yourself for that long and just waiting to do it, when that leaves you, you got a lot of time on your hands. So I decided to come up with another plan, and I figured that what I really need to do is get a job paying more money and marry somebody, and then my life would be perfect. I just got married 6 months ago, and that my life is coming close to that, but my friends at the time who I was sponsoring used to laugh when I got to that point in my story about marriage curing everything. But, you know, anyway, I tried to enact that plan. Didn't work. My life cratered again. So about 5 years later, I find myself getting that nudge from God to go back and try the Al-Anon meeting. I walked into the place that is now my home group. And one of the things they do at every meeting is they read 20 questions from that pamphlet Alan has about 20 questions of did you grow up in a family affected by alcoholism or somebody else is drinking, something like that. And so I'm counting because, you know, it's important to know your score. And I came up with a score of 18 out of 20 because I was lying about two of them. And I was waiting for the person reading that to close with, and if you only have 18, no reason to keep coming here. You may leave now. And that pamphlet ends with, if you have any one of these, Al-Anon may help. And I thought, oh, man, I am so screwed. And I was, once again, I was wrong because I finally found people who had the answer. And, you know, it occurred to me a few years ago that there are people around who were there when I came in. And so when I started speaking, I asked them, what was I like when I came in? And, you know, what the reaction to that really surprised me. Not what they told me, but that the people I asked were hesitant to tell me because they were afraid that information might jeopardize our friendship. Because when I came in, nobody was worried about hurting my feelings because I was problem-oriented, I was outwardly focused, I was not comfortable in my own skin, I tried to control conversations with a depth of knowledge, I would periodically go on full alert if things got too close, I didn't listen well, I was into drama and gossip, but I would have tried to convince you I was a nice guy because appearances are important. And you know, so there I am in Al-Anon, and you know, the only thing I did right those first couple of years is I got a sponsor. I don't know where I heard that. That wasn't something that group talked about, but I did it. Now, I never called him unless you know, unless my things were going horribly wrong and anything like that. And I did wonderful things like, you know, somebody had mentioned the idea that maybe I shouldn't change my relationship status. And, you know, that only applied to people who weren't spiritually advanced like I was. So I broke up with somebody 2 weeks in and started dating somebody else 4 weeks after that, and that only cost me about 2 years of recovery. And, you know, I never called my sponsor until things were bad again. But anyway, I always share that with my sponsees when they say, should I date? I'm going like, well, let me tell you what happened to me, and you can make your own decision. And they always go out and date like I did, so, you know, I guess this attraction thing works. But anyway, after that spiritual awakening thing, my sponsor, who I had been trying to get to run my life for a couple years, and he would never give me any suggestions, suddenly was full of suggestions. Like, why don't you become GR for our group? And I was offended by this. Now, I want to reiterate, my home group has changed. It is not like this anymore. But I thought the GR position was the Al-Anon way that you formally quit. Because in that group at that time, in the 2 or 3 years I've been going to it, we'd had 5 GRs. And the way you were elected GR is during the announcement, you said, I want to be GR. We would say, let's vote. Everybody goes like, yay, we got a GR again. And 2 months later, you could disappear from the face of the earth and never come back to Al-Anon because that's what happened to the previous 5 people. And it occurred to me that my sponsor might be trying to give me a message. So anyway, I got in, started doing service, started getting better, started doing service at the district level, then the area level, the state level. And that's why I started learning about the traditions and the concepts, because I needed to learn rules, not only how to live with myself, which is what the steps helped me with, but how to live with others and play nicely with others. You know, and that's what the traditions helped me with. You know, and really the best thing that came out of working the steps is I didn't get perfect working the steps, which is what I thought was going to happen. You all got to be human because I got to be okay with myself. And, you know, the way the first chapter of that book, How Al-Anon Works, that they just gave out earlier, ends with this sentence that I love. We come to Al-Anon for many different reasons, but we stay for only one. We want our lives to get better. You know, and I've realized that if my life isn't changing and getting better in recovery, I need to talk to somebody. The natural progression of alcoholism is that things get continually worse. The natural progression of recovery is that things get better. And if they're not getting better, you need to talk to somebody. And that's eventually what I did. And when I was able to follow directions and do the simple, stupid, meaningless, this can't possibly touch this problem suggestions that I got, my life got lots better. And when I remember that today, it continues to get better. So what am I like now? I like to think I'm useful. You know, I'm currently working with three guys, taking them through the steps on finances, which is a huge gift for me because I need help on that. You know, when I came in, one of the biggest amends I had to make was the IRS and the State Department of Finance because I hadn't filed taxes in 8 years. You know, and I made it through that by doing just simple things that, you know, my sponsor suggested or that my people who had were, for me, a higher power, like my accountant who knew what to do. And then all I had to do was the next thing, not everything at once. And we got through that. You know, and when I realize now that when I fail to use the 12 steps as a guide to my daily life, the serenity that I achieved in that spiritual awakening leaks from my life. And let me tell you what my definition of was when I first heard that. I think it's like in this bottle of water, like maybe I have two or three small pinholes and it leaks out. I have found that a better visual for that is, you know those spaghetti strainers? Pinholes? Pour water into that and try to hold it. And the only way that I can keep the spiritual awakening is to take that strainer and submerge it in water. And it's just like submerging it in a lake or something like that, just so it's flowing in as fast as it's flowing out. Because if that's happening, I don't realize that it's emptying out because it's filling up as fast as it's going. And that's what the spiritual solution has done for me. And, you know, you guys are in the South, so a lot of you will understand this, but, you know, one of the ideas we kind of live by is that we love people to death. I mean, we love people to death, right? And that's literally what I learned to do in a family, was to love people to death. And what you guys have taught me is how to love people back to life. And, you know, being in the rooms and, you know, being of service to people, it gives me a seat on the 50-yard line of watching God happen to other people. And I didn't know that's what would happen when I started greeting newcomers or started sponsoring people or started doing service work or sitting in those stupid committee meetings where you're arguing over whether you're going to have styrofoam cup or paper cups because, dear God, we don't want to hurt the environment. It's like, ah! Anyway, that is my issue, and my sponsor and I are working on that. But, you know, you guys know what it's like, you know, when a newcomer comes into the room and they're trying to be cool like I was. And, like, we don't know who the newcomer's in, right? You know, 20 people in a room and somebody's new there. And, you know, and you just see that strain that they've been living under and that dead look in their eyes and that shock when we start laughing because they're like I was. They're like, what are you all laughing about? If only you had my problems, you realize this wasn't funny. And then I found out they had problems worse than me. And that was attractive to find out what they were doing. And then you get to see them start to crack a smile. You know, you get to see them come back to life. And sometimes you get to sponsor them. And you get to see it in intimate detail of God happening to somebody else. And it's just awe-inspiring. And, you know, I really appreciate the invitation to come down here because I got to do a 12-step call on the flight here. And I'll talk a little bit more about that at the workshop tomorrow, but it was amazing because I knew what to do because you guys had told me how to do it. And I was useful to somebody else who was suffering from this disease. You know, and all this great stuff started happening in my life, but there was one thing that was still challenging me, and that was my nieces and nephews, because the family disease goes on. And I could see it affecting them as they were growing up. And I knew I had an answer, and I realized I probably wasn't going to be part of that solution. But it hurt to be around them, just to see what was going on. And I didn't know what to do. And so I just kept doing what you all suggested that I do. And what happened to me was about 5 years ago, my mom graciously moved out of her home of 50 years when it was before it was time that we needed to intervene and help her do that. and then 2 years later moved from her apartment out to assisted living before we had to do it. You know, I had some major amends to make to my mom before then, and I did them because you all suggested how to do them. And so I had a relationship and could be part of that process. And so after moving her to Milwaukee, Wisconsin from Washington, D.C., I was out there with them, and she moved into assisted living near my sister. And so we were driving around. I was driving. They were helping. And so I'm white-knuckling it because I'm getting a lot of advice. And my mom mentions that my dad was very careful with what he drank because he didn't want to be the type of alcoholic my grandfather was, who was such a bad alcoholic. He had to help start AA to get better. And I'm going like, what? I had never heard this story. Now, after that reverse intervention, I have decided never to bring up that issue again and figure that if time comes where it needs to come up, God will find the time, and this did not seem like it. So I didn't know how to find out about this. And so I called one of my sponsees and said, like, how can I find out about this? This is, you know, this is an honest program. How can I find out? And he goes, Google it, dude. I'm like, okay, you know. I'm willing, you know, and it's fortunately I have a unique spelling in my last name, Sherman. And the reason I thought there might be some truth to this is my grandfather lived in New York City and had a summer home in Bedford, New York, which is where Stepping Stones was. So just possibly. So anyway, I Googled it, and for those of you who are into AA history, you know that, you know, they got together, you know, Bill and Bob got together, then the group of them wrote the big book. And then there was the Saturday Evening Post article that kind of exploded everything. Well, there was actually an event between the big book and the Saturday Evening Post article where they got together with J.D. Rockefeller, who was going to give them all sorts of money and really let this thing take off. And fortunately, that never happened. But what he did do is he invited 400 of his closest friends to hear about this alcoholism thing, the cure for it, and let them come talk to him. Well, you know, when J.D. Rockefeller holds a party, especially about this crazy alcoholism thing, it made the papers. And it was a social event, so they listed who was there. And when I Googled it, my grandfather's name came up. Now, they did not identify in that article who was a member of AA and who was not. And this is before those traditions, you know, were really solidified, so I don't know what. But my grandfather's name was on that list. And there are other stories around my families of this, so I choose to believe that my grandfather was a member. And when I heard that, it dawned on me. He died 4 months after I was born. But you know, there's probably some thread between New York AA and Richmond Al-Anon some 40 years later that it was waiting for me because of stuff he had done, and that all I had to do was do the work that was put in front of me, and that God could work in their lives like he had in mine, and I didn't have to sweat it. And that was incredibly freeing. And one thing that helps me really puts that sentiment into words is a saying I heard Danny Hillis. He's a futurist. You know, he talks about the internet and what the world's going to be like, and he tells this story about his work. He says, I think of the oak beams in the ceiling of College Hall at New College, Oxford. Last century, when the beams needed replacing, carpenters used oak trees that had been planted in 1386, when the dining hall had been first built. The 14th century builder had planted the trees in anticipation of a time, hundreds of years in the future, when the beams would need replacing. I sense that I am alive at a time of important change and feel a responsibility to make sure that the change comes out well. I plant my acorns knowing that I will never live to harvest the oaks, but I have hope in the future. You all gave me that. And we have a simple saying that encapsulates that. Pass it on. And thank you for letting me share my story to pass on a little bit of what I've experienced. And you all, I'm looking forward for the rest of this weekend. Thank you.